history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that need to be told, and we're always better off having heard them. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained. So often we leave inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. You know, it's been quite a few years since the late Louis Zamperini shared his story here on Hometown Heroes, but not only is it a story that never gets old, it's a story that keeps getting better because the impact of his incredible life continues to grow. Typically, we spend the hour talking to a veteran whose name you've never heard, but the Zamperini name was in the headlines more than 80 years ago as a track star, and in quite a few more headlines in recent years as his story of Olympian turned airman turned prisoner of war has amazed people around the world. Perhaps you've read the best-selling book Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand. Maybe you've seen the acclaimed film by the same name. But the reality we'll focus on today is that neither the book nor the film would exist without the dramatic turnaround in the guy they once called Lucky Louis' life after he came home from captivity in World War II. Like countless veterans then and so many veterans today, Louis Zamperini dealt with the terrorizing effects of post-traumatic stress disorder. The story of that haunting pain and how he overcame that to become a shining example of resilience, grace, and forgiveness is told in the new film Unbroken, Path to Redemption, which opens September 14th in theaters nationwide. While the first Unbroken film, directed by Angelina Jolie, told of his extreme experiences in World War II and his incredible will to survive, it didn't have time to capture his post-war journey, which proved to be just as fierce a battle. The sequel, put together by the same producer, picks up where the first film leaves off, and it shows us the role his wife Cynthia played in his transformation and what it took for Louis to get to the point that he could return to Japan and forgive those who had beaten and tortured him. Before we're done, we're going to hear from a few voices, including the author of Unbroken, Laura Hillenbrand, who was kind enough to join us, and from Louis himself from years ago. But let's start with the audio from this short trailer for Unbroken, Path to Redemption.
Bless you, Louis. Welcome home. All of Torrance was praying for your safe return.
Miracles didn't save me, Padre. A couple of atomic bombs did that.
You're Louis Zamperini, aren't you? Thank you.
For what?
For preserving the free world for silly girls like me.
People from all over the country want to know if you're going to run in the London Olympics.
I don't run to run. I run to win.
I just thought I'd be able to forget everything.
You're having any night sweats or nightmares?
You need help.
Here tonight, there's a drowning man. But there's a lifeline. Just reach out.
These men did terrible things to you. What are you gonna say to them?
If you've read Unbroken or heard Louis' story, you know what he said to them, but you'll see it and feel it in this new film. By the way, you can watch that official trailer at unbrokenfilm.com. I also have it up for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where you will find information about the red carpet event that's going to take place in Fresno, California on September 15th. Louis' son Luke Zamperini will be there, as will the actor who plays Louis in this new film. You may know him from the series Chicago PD. Samuel C. Hunt says the chance to portray Louis Zamperini, and especially this emotional portion of his story, is the role of a lifetime.
And the reason that Path to Redemption, I think, is so important and that it's an essential part of the overall arc of who this man was and what his story means to people is that we all have experienced trauma, we all have experienced heartache, and oftentimes it makes us better, but what we don't usually deal with or we don't usually understand is that there is a second wave that comes from our perseverance and from our victories. And sometimes that second wave is actually the thing that is gonna force us to make the most growth and step into the people that we, into kind of our true selves. So this point in his life is about him when he's at almost at his most vulnerable. He's at his most exposed to his own demons and his things that he can't hide from. He can't just figure his way through.
To be part of telling Louis Zamperini's story, it's pretty indescribable. You're talking about one of the greatest American heroes in our history, not only through his actions, but also just as a human being, and the way that he dedicated his life after the fact, you know, what he went through, where he came from, then how he dedicated his life. I mean, the story is just immense. When it comes to acting, that's all you want to do. So you really, you just want to tell great stories. You want to be a part of great stories. And so the source material on this is just uncanny. You know, it's second to none. So to have that an opportunity to not only be a part of it, but to be the guy is overwhelming, but just incredibly exciting. There's an importance to why we need to understand forgiveness and believe in the power of forgiveness. To forgive is truly one of the most selfless things that you can do in your life, because it allows other people to be themselves, it allows other people to move forward as well, and it allows you to move forward and grow as a human being. I would explain Unbroken Path to Redemption by saying how it's a story about the human spirit, you know, hopefully as an inspiring story for people who find themselves in it, those particular points in their life where they look around and they feel like there's nothing else that they can latch onto, there's nothing else they can connect with.
So many people, including author Laura Hillenbrand, who we'll hear from in a bit, have found themselves in those places. And Louis Zamperini's persevering spirit has had a giant impact in their lives. Louis passed away in 2014, but his family remains committed to carrying on his legacy. Louis's son, Luke Zamperini, knows just how important it was to his father for people to draw hope and strength and inspiration from what he experienced after World War II.
Coming home from the war was not the end of his story. It was really only just the beginning. What we're covering in Unbroken, the Path to Redemption, of course, is the rest of the story, at least up to the point where he goes back to forgive his prison guards. What wasn't covered in the first film was, of course, the effects of the war in the prison camp on my dad. He had post-traumatic stress disorder, which, of course, they didn't know what that was in those days. And it was really taking a toll on his life and his marriage. He began to self-medicate. He began to become very much a different person, very angry, very combative. I mean, if you cut him off in the roadway, he'd pull you over and pull you out of the car and beat the stuffing out of you. And so when he was at the end of his rope finally and went into that Billy Graham tent meeting in 1949 and was reconciled to his maker, that changed his life. And his post-traumatic stress disorder was gone in an instant, miraculously. Now, that doesn't happen to everybody that comes to faith in Jesus Christ, but it certainly happened to my dad. And it's just another miracle in his life that makes the story so compelling. You know, in the book Unbroken, Laura Hillenbrand brought out the fact that there were thousands of GIs that had crashed into the Pacific Ocean and probably had the same experience that my dad had, drifting on life rafts and sharks and all that, but he lived to tell about it. And the fact that he was a famous athlete that seemingly had come back from the dead at the end of the war was really wonderful, and it was a great story. But having the post-traumatic stress disorder and going down the tubes, his story would have never have had the impact that it had, with him being able to find redemption and then be able to forgive his captors and indeed go back to Japan and look them in the eye and tell them, I love you and I forgive you. That's what makes the story so remarkable. My dad often said that if you hate somebody, you're not doing anything to that person. That person is not feeling your hatred, but the hatred is eating you alive. So the forgiveness was essential to my father being able to heal himself. And so, but you ask yourself, how do you forgive someone who's beat you every day for 2 years? My dad had to love the bird, Watanabe, with the same love that God had for him when he sent his son to the cross to die for his sin and our sins. That's pretty big. And that's, the Bible says, with men these things are impossible, but with God all things are possible.
Anyone who has read Unbroken or seen the first film knows that so much of Louis Zamperini's story defies what most of us would view as possible. That, of course, is what makes it so powerful. And what's more impactful than hearing the story from Louis himself? His incredible enthusiasm and energy well into his 90s was one of the things people marveled at the most before his passing in 2014 at the age of 97. We had the privilege of hearing him share his story here on Hometown Heroes in 2011, and we're going to listen back to some of that today. You can link to the original episode, complete with his adventures on and off the track at the 1936 Olympics, at hometownheroesradio.com. But for the purposes of our focus today, we're going to start in late May 1943. Louis, who had already survived some very close calls as a B-24 bombardier in the Pacific, was sent on a search and rescue mission that would forever alter the course of his life.
It was a weird situation. When you go on a search mission, that's an all-day flight looking for enemy ships and enemy submarines. And when you get back, you get 2 days off. And we got back, and we were heading for the main gate when the operations officer drove out in a Jeep and told us to halt it. And they said a B-25 is reported going down 200 miles north of the island of Palmyra, and we want you to go look for him. Well, we know our plane was being serviced. But he said, well, there's the Green Hornet. Well, nobody wanted to fly the Green Hornet. It couldn't get off of the ground with a bomb load. And when it did get off the ground, it was a musher. Tail was down, the nose was up. And he said, well, it passed inspection, and so that's like an order. So we decided to go down and look for the B-25. And so another plane flew ahead of us from another field in Hawaii, and we got down just where the plane reported last, and we began to circle. Now, the cloud cover was broken cloud at 1,000 feet. Now, we fly a search mission at 1,000 feet so you can see something. However, because of the broken cloud, we couldn't really see the ocean, so we flew under. That put us down to 800 feet, and we're scanning the ocean, and suddenly the number one motor goes out. Well, that plane could hardly fly on four, so we're having a struggle, and just as they were trying to keep the plane straight and level and keep the altitude, the number two motor goes out. Well, with two motors on this plane, the Green Hornet just nosed over to the left wing down and just plowed right into the ocean and blew up. Pieces all over the place. Oxygen tank, gas tank, and what have you, and then, of course, the plane sank. But there were two life rafts that ejected from the plane automatically. I was trapped in the waist section. My job is to hold a deflated raft in my arms in front of me. And as soon as we crashed, I ducked down low behind the tripod of the machine gun mount, and I ended up under the mount with the raft under my belly and my back up against the tripod. So I'm in there so solid, I doubt if two men could have got me out. And then the tail snapped off. When the tail snapped off, all the control wires go within an inch and a half of the tripod. And those are springy wires. They just curl up. They curled up all around me to make my situation even tougher. And I knew this was it. I knew that it started to sink. And I felt my ears pop, so I knew I was down 20 feet. And then I kept sinking down into the darkness, and then I felt a terrible pain in my forehead. And I don't know what that was, but it felt like someone hit me with a sledgehammer. And then I lost consciousness. Now, before I lost consciousness, I just said to myself, God help me. And then I lost consciousness, and then while I'm still sinking to greater depths, even greater pressure, I'm conscious again. And just momentarily, I felt a kind of a euphoria that, hey, this is the afterlife. I knew there was no way I could get out. And then I realized I was still in the plane, and I was fighting for air, so I started to flail around with my arms. I'm in the waist section of the ship, pitch dark, and my USC ring on my index finger snagged onto the waist window. And that's what I was looking for. And then I realized what it was. I pulled myself out, inflated my life jacket, swallowing everything. I swallowed gas, oil, and blood all the way to the surface, threw it all up. And then I came up and looked. I heard, help, help. So the pilot and tail gunner were over hanging onto a gas tank, and they saw me. And they called it, help, help. So the life raft was drifting away in the current, so I'm trying to catch the raft. But I'm fully clothed with shoes on, and I couldn't catch the raft. And I thought, this is it. We're dead. And then as I turned back to look at the pilot and the tail gunner, there's a 100-foot cord attached to the trigger on the CO2 cartridge on the raft. And it's also embedded in the fuselage of the ship. And that's what inflates that raft. As I looked over towards the other two guys, the last 3 feet of that cord was going by my face. somewhat submerged. I couldn't really see it until it got close to me. And I grabbed that and reeled the raft back in, and that saved our lives, that raft. And then I rode to my buddies, and the pilot's head had two gashes. Blood was spurting, arterial blood. And so I had to, first of all, get a compress made out of my T-shirt. And I took another T-shirt and tied that down tight. And the funny thing is, I heard a gurgling sound. I looked around, I couldn't see anything, and then I never heard another sound. So somebody had come to the surface, badly wounded, and just trying to say help, I guess. But it sounded gurgling, and then we couldn't find anything. So whoever it was, it just came to the surface momentarily and then sank.
8 of the 11 men on that bomber died in the crash. And we'll hear Louis Zamperini pick it up from there when we come back. But consider for a moment just the sheer improbability of his surviving what you just heard him describe. If he hadn't made it through, we wouldn't be talking about this new movie, Unbroken, Path to Redemption, let alone the movie or book that preceded it. We're going to hear from the author of that book, Laura Hillenbrand, before we're done today, and more in Louis' own words when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I've found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to explore a World War II story that I never get tired of hearing. We're talking about the late Louis Zamperini today because the film Unbroken, Path to Redemption is about to hit theaters nationwide. It opens September 14th. A red carpet event will take place September 15th with three different showings that include a chance to mingle with Louis's son Luke, as well as actors from the film. Samuel C. Hunt, who plays Louis, will be there, as will Bob Gunton, who I'm sure you remember as the warden in The Shawshank Redemption, and who now has found another redemption story to be a part of. That red carpet event will be in Fresno, California, where Louis once competed in the famed West Coast Relays as a record-breaking runner for the University of Southern California. You'll hear more about the new film in a bit, including what Laura Hillenbrand, the author of Unbroken, has to say about it. But for now, let's go back 75 years to May 1943. He somehow escaped that sinking airplane, but when he came to the surface as one of only three initial survivors out of a crew of 11, he had no idea he'd be spending the next 47 days floating on a raft.
So there's three of us now in the raft. The tail gunner, within 30 minutes, he starts screaming, we're going to die, we're all going to die. And that was pathetic. And I turned to him and said, look it. Nobody's going to die. We'll be rescued this afternoon or tomorrow or the next day. It settled down, Mac, and he wouldn't settle down. He kept screaming, so I tried to use psychology on him. I'd taken a course in psychology at USC, Psychology 51. It didn't work. So I threatened him. I said, when we're picked up, I'm making a report to the commander, and you'll be in real trouble. He kept on screaming. So I turned my back on him, and I came around with a backhand on my knuckles. I cracked him across the face and knocked him on his butt, and he just lay there in complete contentment. He had a half smile on his face. A week later, or 5 days later, I had to do the same thing again, and after that, no problem. In fact, he got better and better as we went along instead of worse and worse. I thought if anybody hallucinates, it'll be him. But we buried him on the 33rd day, and he was sharper than he's ever been in his life. We had a program of mental exercises every day during the whole trip of 47 days. And our minds kept improving more and more. In fact, we were sharper after 47 days than we were the day we crashed.
Well, and this is unbelievable, and I know you lived it, and you've told the story so many times, and you just described it. But I'm imagining myself as someone who doesn't know your story and hearing this, and I want to highlight here some of the things. There were 11 men on your crew. Three of you survived initially, and you just said 47 days. You had to survive for 47 days lost at sea. How did you do that?
Well, the will to live. Now, I have a lot of young people say, well, did you ever think about dying out there? I said, not once. We never talked about dying. We only talked about living. And that fortified our constitution, you see. And then we had every day without telling them, I would come up with mental exercises like memorizing songs. Okay, I would teach them the hit top 40 songs. Dad was a minister. He'd teach us the words to the songs in the hymnal book.
Mm-hmm.
And every day we'd have some exercise, thinking back as far as you can think. And what are you going to do after the war? Every day we had something to keep our minds occupied, because my professor at SC, Dr. Webster, told us in class that the brain is like a muscle. Unless you exercise it every day, it will atrophy.
Now, so you told your crewmates the day that you crashed that, yeah, we'll be rescued tomorrow or later today. You survived 47 days hoping to be rescued by friendly forces. It's the Japanese who end up finding you. They're interrogating you. You've gone from 165 pounds to 65. Yet it seems like the way you describe it now, you woke up every day energized to make it to the next day.
Right. Well, we had a strong will to live. There was no problem out there. We never thought about death or even talked about it. On the 27th day, that was our worst day on the 27th. That's when a plane flew over. It looked like a B-25 American plane. We shot flares through what had died in the ocean. The plane came down real low. We took our shirts off. We were waving at them. And we knew we'd be rescued. And then we heard machine gun firing, and the bullets went right between our legs, and one hit the metal pump on one raft, and it tore the whole bottom of the raft out. We only had one raft, three of us in that raft. Actually, 48 holes in that little raft, and none of us are touched by a bullet. You talk about another miracle, that was it.
Amen.
That went on for 30 minutes of strafing, and then they finally opened up their bomb bay doors and dropped the depth charge. The depth charge missed us about 50 feet, which would have killed us. But it failed to explode, so the bombardier improperly armed the bomb, and so fortunately we lived through that. And then it was a miserable time trying to patch that raft to keep it afloat, because it was wrinkled, laying flat in the water, two sharks around us, and we had to keep pumping, and bubbles kept coming out. And then we just put as many patches on the top as we could, and then we got it in pretty good shape, and then we had to patch the bottom. Now that's a trick. The raft is in two pieces. There's two tubes. So we let the air out of one half, pulled it up, and let it dry, and tried to put a patch on it while we're sitting on the other half. In the meantime, there's always two sharks, always two of them. I don't know why they don't come in threes. And they were coming up trying to get us from the rear. So the tail gunner's job was to have an oar, and he would jab them on the nose. There's something about a shark's nose that they don't like. As a matter of fact, I found out last year, a great white, when they stuck his nose out of the water, they touched it with their hands, and he became docile. The trick is to get him on the nose, and so that's what I did underwater. I straight on the sharks, two of them, while the strafing was going on, and when I'd hit them on the nose, they'd take off. But they come back, because they're still hungry. So the raft, we got in pretty good shape. We only had to pump up once every hour. And then, of course, Mac died on the 33rd day. I was surprised he lived that long.
I know that your time's limited, Louie, and I don't want to accelerate you too far here, but you end up as a prisoner of war of the Japanese. And this is incredible to me as well. One of the gentlemen who ended up interrogating you was one of your USC classmates?
Yeah. He said, when you were entering USC in 36, I was graduating. He was on the interrogation panel. Then an officer from another division on Kwajalein, he followed American sports and USC football and the Olympics. And so he came to the panel and said, instead of executing, our day of execution was already set. And anyway, he said it would better serve Japan's purpose to send him on to Japan to make propaganda broadcasts. Well, it made sense. I said, hey, great idea. So we got to go to Japan. And then, sure enough, they asked me to make a broadcast to my parents, which I wrote. And then they said, oh, you have beautiful radio voice. We want you to make another broadcast. At this time, they wrote the script, and it was propaganda, and I refused. And I think that's what Laura meant by being unbroken, unharassed and unbroken here, because they had me severely punished on a daily basis because I wouldn't make the broadcast. And then they finally sent me to a slave labor camp, and I still wouldn't give in. And the war ended there at Camp 4B in Nowetsu, about 35 miles from Nagano, where the Olympics were held.
Yeah, and there's a story there, too. And now you talk about that first broadcast that you got to make for your parents' benefit. Now, at that time, they believed that you had died, right?
Yeah, but the broadcast was so scrambly, the government wouldn't accept it as me. My parents were pretty sure it was me because I mentioned a few items that only they knew, but it was so incoherent that the Army said, no, there's no proof that he's alive, and so they kept me dead.
Wow. This is Louis Zamperini. He mentioned Unbroken. That, of course, the title of the best-selling book by Laura Hillenbrand, who also wrote Seabiscuit and another fast finisher in Louis Zamperini, her newest topic. His book is Devil at My Heels. Louis Zamperini, full of life, and obviously you had to be to survive everything you did. You're captured in July of 43. Of course, the war doesn't end until 1945. More than 2 years in captivity. What was the hardest thing to endure that the Japanese did to you? What was the toughest thing for you to overcome?
Everything. On a daily basis, I'm beaten. And so I have to keep as far away from Watanabe, the bird we called him. And so I'm in a barracks with about 70 other men. So I always stayed in the back of the barracks because they come in for inspection. Two guards come in first and holler Chef K, and so you come to attention. And then the bird does whatever he does. So he comes in. I'm way in the back. He came in, and he looked around for about 5 or 7 seconds. He kept looking around for me, and he saw me. And he hollered, you come to attention last. Well, he looked around for a long time before he said that. And I didn't come to attention last, but he wanted to work me over. So he called me up. He had a big web belt about a 3/8 of an inch thick and 4 inches wide, and a 1-pound steel buckle on the end, big, big buckle. He took his belt off and hit me across the forehead, knocked me to the ground. Now, I don't go down easily, but I'm laying there bleeding, and then he took out a piece of toilet paper, and he handed it to me, and he said, oh, like, I'm sorry. And I said, well, he can't be that bad. So I wiped the blood. I stood up. I took the tissue, and I pulled it away from my head to look to see how much blood was on it, and they hit me again in the same spot.
Oh.
This time I stayed down, but I got that, that was almost on a daily basis, the beatings from him, and I guess they gave word somehow that because I refused to make the broadcast on Tokyo Rose's program, that I was to be punished repeatedly. So I took a beating there, and then I thought, well, if I go to a slave labor camp, I'll get away from him. But they transferred him a week earlier. Now they have 100 camps in Tokyo proper. And they sent him to the very camp that I came to, so I had to put up with him again.
Holy moly.
And again, he threatened my life over and over again. And he said, if I draw my sword, I must use it. That's samurai law, you know. And then he had me take care of a sick goat. The goat was dying. He says, the goat dies, you die. Well, I knew the goat was going to die, and he did too. When the goat died, he took me outside and called everybody out, all the prisoners, hundreds. And I'm standing out there alone, and then he walks back and forth with his hand on his sword. The goat die, you die. And then finally he got two guys to bring over a big 4x6 cherry wood log, which is heavy, about 6-8 feet long. And he made me hold it over my head. Well, I held it for 10 minutes that I can remember, and then I went numb. And Henley Wade from England, he had a watch, and he timed it 37 minutes. I couldn't believe I held it that long, but I wasn't conscious of holding it after the first 10 minutes.
And if you've seen the film Unbroken, released just after Louis' passing in 2014, that may be the scene you remember the most. Those are the kind of memories that would end up triggering PTSD after the war, and things that still proved heavy when Louis first read the best-selling book about his life, as we hear from Louis's daughter, Cynthia.
Even when our father was reading the book, he waited 7 years to be able to read Unbroken, and he was so excited to get an advanced copy. And he said, I called him days later and asked him, how was it? And he hardly had any words. He said he had to keep putting it down and looking out to remind himself where he was, because the book was so detailed, it put him emotionally right back there.
And no one described the emotions, good or bad, quite like Louis Zamperini himself. Here's how he described his liberation from that Japanese prison camp on Hometown Heroes.
Well, that was it was a beautiful day. We were suspicious. You see, there's always rumors the war's over, so we didn't believe anything. But this one guard came to me and he said, a horrible thing happened in a city called Hiroshima. A cholera broke out, and nobody can communicate with Hiroshima. And I thought, cholera, my God, how horrible. I'm glad we're hundreds of miles north. But that was the first atomic bomb, and the Japanese lied to the public. Mm-hmm. But then when the second bomb was dropped, they told the truth immediately because they had no choice. So that ended the war, and then a plane flew over, and we wrote PW on the roof. They circled left, and then the bird disappeared. He knew the war was over before we did. He skipped out and hid out in the mountains for 10 or 12 years. In the meantime, a TBF flew over from a carrier and sent us the Morse code in red light, that the war was over. And we were in the river for the first time swimming. We always wanted to go in that fresh water to clean ourselves. They wouldn't let us do it. But then the day they let us do it, I thought, well, maybe the war is over. So anyway, we came out of there, and the TBF dropped a long red streamer, and we picked it up, and on the end was a candy bar with a bite out of it and a pack of cigarettes with one cigarette missing. We had to divide both of those up with several hundred men. We had to form circles, and one cigarette. Everybody takes one puff, and so it goes around the circle. It was really funny, but we were serious. And then the chocolate, we got a little teeny sliver just to taste it, and that was it. Now, Commander Fitzgerald of the Perch submarine, he was in command, a highest-ranking officer with us, and he made sure that everybody got one puff of cigarette and a little taste of the chocolate. And then, of course, the B-29s came over and dropped tons of food on us, and instead of hating the guards, they were complaining about their families starving at home, so we gave them a lot of food from the bombers.
Well, your stomachs probably couldn't take that much anyway.
The commander warned the guys, you haven't been eating good food. You've been eating seaweed and barley for years, and so take it easy on the food. Well, some guys were so hungry, they just, pea soup was supposed to be diluted with a can of water, and they would eat it straight. So some guys got diarrhea from that, but the smart guys just ate a little more every day until they got used to it. I took my time coming home, by the way. I got fattened up. And I was back to a normal weight by the time I got to San Francisco. And that's another story, the repatriation. You could do another book on that.
I believe it. Maybe you should.
Anyway, I went to hell and almost got killed on the way home. There was a bomber. We were supposed to fly to Manila, but socked in. I'm leaving Okinawa now. I'm gradually working my way home. And we were told to land at Loag, a small city in northern Luzon, on a fighter strip, stayed there all night. Next day, they gave us clearance to go to Manila, and we took off with this bomber full of about 40 prisoners inside, and the runway's too short. There was a berm on the end of the runway that they put there to keep the ocean from flooding the runway, and I was up there between the pilot and co-pilot, and I knew we weren't going to make it, and they did too. We hit the berm, bounced in the air, and settled so low that the white caps came through the bomb bay doors and got all the prisoners wet. And I thought, this is it. After all I've been through, I'm dead. And then the plane gradually pulled up. We got to Manila. A couple of years ago, I got a call from a fellow in the East, and he asked me how I got to Manila. When I told him about that bomber taking off, he said, well, I was the pilot, and I almost went in my pants. So yeah, anyway, that's really funny. Yeah, so anyway, I got home, and of course, big celebrations, and I had a ball, and then I finally got married.
And in all the attention deservedly given to Louis, his wife, Cynthia, often is relegated to unsung hero. But the actress who plays Cynthia in Unbroken, Path to Redemption, is excited to highlight the role of a committed and resilient wife in Louis's post-war transformation. Merritt Patterson has the privilege of portraying Cynthia.
I actually read the book first, and I loved the book. I thought it was incredible. It's such an incredible story. It's almost unbelievable. Like, here's this boy that, you know, came from a rough part of the city and didn't have a lot growing up, and he becomes a runner, and then he becomes a world-class athlete and gets to go to the Olympics. And it's just, I mean, that could be a story on its own. That could be its own story. And then he goes to war, and that's a whole other story. It's like he has all these life stories in one lifetime. It's pretty incredible. And the first movie shows the beginning of his life, and it shows the war, and it shows the prisoner of war camp. And then that's kind of where it ends. And this movie is a great opportunity to show the next part of his life. And it was a huge, huge, important part of his life. I mean, what happened after the war was life-altering for him. And it was a struggle. And I think people want to see that. And I also think that going through what he went through and struggling with PTSD and alcoholism, not only can people relate to that, but also the fact that he's able to come out of that. There's hope there. And he goes through some incredible struggles, and he's able to come out the other side with his wife. It's just a really great story, and I think people deserve to see that side. And they didn't know each other that well before they got married, so they go through a lot of trials and tribulations, and the story is really about them and their love for each other and their relationship and working through a lot of these issues, and eventually that brings them to faith.
And that faith would be the element of his story that Louis Zamperini was the most intent on sharing, and sharing passionately right up until his passing at age 97 in 2014. The Reverend Billy Graham, by the way, is portrayed in this new film by his grandson, Will Graham. Unbroken, Path to Redemption opens nationwide September 14th. When we come back, a few more of Louis's own words about what he dealt with after World War II, and then Laura Hillenbrand, author of Unbroken, on the impact Louis has had on her personally and what she thinks of the new film. Watch the trailer or link to more info online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to celebrate the legacy of the inimitable Louis Zamperini, whose persevering legacy is captured in the new film Unbroken, Path to Redemption, which continues where the first blockbuster film left off. In a moment, we'll talk to Laura Hillenbrand, the best-selling author who spent 7 years of her life working on the book Unbroken about Louis's life. It's a story we never would have known if Louis did not experience a remarkable transformation that delivered him from the throes of PTSD. He told us about that metamorphosis when he shared his story on Hometown Heroes in 2011 at the age of 94.
I had a terrible nightmares. I had these nightmares in prison about the bird. I was always strangling the guy, and I had that nightmare all the way home. I never missed a night. Before I got married, I had a nightmare every night. After I got married, I still had the nightmares. I'm always strangling the bird, and I grabbed my wife by the throat one night, and boy, I got scared. I woke up in a cold sweat. Then I started to drink heavily and became a boozer. And then she decided it was time for a divorce. But then somebody talked her into going down to hear a new young evangelist, Billy Graham. And she came home speaking of this peace and joy she had in her heart and life, and I wouldn't go with her. I got mad, but then she said something that made me happy. She said, because of my conversion, I'm not going to get a divorce. That softened me up a little bit, so I did go down to Hillbilly. But I walked out the first night mad. I said, I'll never go back to that place again. But the next day, after 2 hours of arguments, he got me back. As I started to leave, he was, in his preaching, he said, when people come to the end of their rope, and there's nowhere else to turn, they turn to God, no matter who you are. I thought, yeah, that's what happened to me on the raft in prison camp on Kwajalein. And that made me feel like a fool. I prayed the same prayer over and over again, God, get me home alive, and I'll seek you and serve you. Here I am alive, and I didn't try to seek God. So then I went forward in the meeting and made a confession of my faith in Christ, and boy, I knew something happened. I was still on my knees, but I knew I was through getting drunk. I knew I'd forgiven all my guards, and including the bird. That was something. And I was a different person. Right there on my knees, I got up, went home, and that's, my life has been changed ever since.
And you eventually became a missionary in Japan, the same country that had tortured you. You talked about the bird and you forgave him. I guess you did, if you would go back there to Japan to try to share this new love in your life with them.
I went back to Japan, Sagamo Prison. That's where all the prisoners were, 850 of them, and nobody was allowed in there. But I called MacArthur's headquarters, SAC, and reminded him that he asked for 10 million Bibles and 2,000 missionaries when he took over the country, but we didn't respond. And that's all. He let me into the Sagamo prison, so I was the first outsider allowed in there to speak, and 850 war criminals. And the colonel asked me to give them a chance to become Christians, so I did. And then he asked those who knew me to come forward, so about eight guards came forward, and sure enough, there was James Sasaki, head interrogator in Japan proper, and he's the one that went to SC with me in 37, 38, 39. So I said, well, where's the bird? And he said, well, we believe he committed harakiri. So I assumed he was dead all these years, and then when CBS did my show out of Nagano during the Olympics, Donna Mihailovich was in Tokyo, and he called me and he said, are you sitting down? Yeah. You got a hold of your chair? I said, I got a hold of my chair. What's up? He says, we found the bird. He's alive. Oh, I couldn't believe it. So anyway, they took a picture of a movie of him. And it was on 60 Minutes, and it's still being shown across the nation. The Olympic Committee sends him out to schools. Everybody can see the entire story in about 35 minutes. They called it the Great Zamperini, which I didn't like, but he said, well, you know, there was the Great Mussolini, the Great Zucchini, and the Great Houdini. So I thought, well, in that case, I'll leave it.
You prefer Lucky Louie, huh?
Yeah, Lucky Louie's fine. A great. I don't think anybody's great.
And perhaps that's part of what made Louie so great. Louie Zamperini's story will reach even more people with the release of Unbroken, Path to Redemption on September 14th. And Laura Hillenbrand, whose book Unbroken has sold millions and millions and millions of copies, is excited about the new film. She first became familiar with Louie's story 20 years ago when she saw that 60 Minutes piece from the Olympics in Nagano that you just heard Louie reference. She had no idea how enormous a worldwide phenomenon his story would become, but she did know she needed to capture his story in print.
I had to write a book about him. It just, when we had our first conversation, he told me his whole story. We talked for quite a long time, and I was just astonished by it and so compelled by all the questions that raised in my mind about how a person can forgive the unforgivable and recover from suffering as deep as he went through. I had no thoughts about what the audience might be for this, but I did think people would be interested in it. No, I didn't. I don't think anybody expects the reach the story has had. But then again, why shouldn't I have expected it? He has maybe the most extraordinary life I've ever heard of.
It really is. And what's amazing is he'd been telling his story to small groups, large groups for a long time, but yet most of the world didn't know about it until you put it in print.
A lot of history goes to the grave with people. A lot of history just goes untold, and it's a wonderful privilege to be able to talk to these people who have lived superlative lives, as Louie did, and to be able to write it down, to try to research and learn more about their own lives than they knew themselves, you know, about things that were happening because of them or around their story, and to try to tell the whole thing in context. It's a great privilege, and it's a great pleasure.
Well, and you did a phenomenal job with the book, and I'm sure you hear that all the time, but I know what it meant to Louie to have his story accurate. depicted in print, and then you have film. And the first one came out, rightfully so. It got through World War II and then stopped. Had she done everything, people would have been an all-day affair at the theater. To see that continued and to see the rest of his story told, how important is that, that people get this second film and the content within it?
I'm so happy with this second film, and I was happy with the first one. I think there were people who didn't understand how difficult it would be to tell Louis's entire life story in the span of 2 hours. You just can't do it. It's too big a story. It's too long a life. But I'm very happy that this is going to become a companion to it, Path to Redemption, because it gets very deeply into the post-traumatic stress disorder Louis had and what happens to people in the aftermath of war. And it tells it very truthfully. This is a very, very accurate movie, beautifully acted. And I'm absolutely positive Louis would be thrilled with it. He wanted people to understand this kind of thing. He wanted our hearts to be open to the pain that veterans go through, as well as the possibility of coming all the way back from that, of recovering from that and having a joyful life, which is what he did. So I'm just thrilled with it. I think the movie is such a beautiful film. It left me in tears at the end.
Well, and I'm sure a lot of our audience will experience something similar. And isn't it interesting that Louis passed away right before this film hit theaters? And then Billy Graham passes away right before his grandson portrays him in the second film.
That's true. I didn't think about the second part of that, yes.
And it just hit me just as we're talking here. And I'm sure you've been asked this a lot, and it's hard to come up with one thing. But when people ask you about Louis, about your interactions with him or your experience in capturing his story, if there's one single greatest significant aspect of who he was and what the rest of us can learn from his experience and the way he handled it, what do you think that would be?
I think what Louis and the life he lives has taught us is that our potential to be resilient, to endure, and to overcome is far greater than we give ourselves credit for. We are not going to be going through the same experiences he went through. But most of us are going to face things in our lives that are bigger than we are, or so we think. And what Louis has to say about that is, it's not bigger than you. Nothing's bigger than you. You can overcome this. You can apply your resilience. You have it in you. And I hear it all the time, and he did too, that, you know, if you got through what you got through, I can get through this cancer. I can get through this loss, or I can get through this thing I fear. And I think that's what he wanted people to know. It was very, very important to him to use his suffering for good. And that's what he did. He taught us this lesson. I carry it with me every day of my life.
Well, and that was my follow-up, and I don't want to cross any lines or get too personal if you don't want to, but as you say that, I'm thinking, boy, it sure sounds like Laura has applied this in her own life, that there's things that you've had to take that, you know, fighting spirit that Louis exemplified and apply it to your own circumstances.
Well, one of the things Louis knew that a lot of people didn't know about me is that I've had a pretty terrible chronic illness for 30 years, something called myalgic encephalomyelitis, and it was a devastating illness that for a number of years left me completely bedridden. And for much of the time that I worked on the book, I actually was bedridden. And Louis knew this, and because he knew it, he felt that I could understand something about suffering and about confinement and being separated from your body's capacity to do what it does naturally, you know, to be an athlete or to just be out in the world. He knew I got that, even though I hadn't been through the same kind of experience he had been through. And it enabled him, he said, to really open up to me in a way that he hadn't with anybody else, to really, really tell me the story, because veterans very often fear opening up about what they went through because they're afraid people will not understand and it will be trivialized to them. It will look like it did in bad old war movies that don't really capture what these things are. And it was an interesting place where Louis and I met, this place of suffering and deprivation. And I was able to take his strength sometimes when I was feeling really badly. I could talk to him and I could be renewed. I could keep going. When it was very, very hard. There was a span while I was writing this book that for 2 years I was unable to leave my house because I was simply too weak to walk to my car. And Louis helped carry me through that time just with his buoyance, his effervescence, his belief in me. And that was a beautiful thing. He actually, after he learned about my illness, which I did not tell him about for quite a while, he read an article on me, and that's how he learned it. He mailed me his Purple Heart, which I was just blown away that he did that. And I said, I cannot accept this. And he said, you deserve this more than I do. And he insisted that I keep it. I still don't think I deserve it. I mean, he deserved it. But this was this thing that we shared, this connection we shared, and it enabled us to be very close and work well together for 7 years.
Wow. Talk about gifts that stick with you, things you can see and things that you can't see, and that's so powerful. Thank you for sharing that with us. And I guess I have to ask you, you know, that you've told this story, and it's turned into not just one, but two films, and of course Seabiscuit was an incredible success. Is there another story you're working on that's going to inspire us and help us face the things that we're dealing with day to day?
I've been looking for a long time for something that has all the things that I need to fall in love with it. And you have to fall in love with your story to do a really good job with it. You know, you have to be obsessed so that you can follow every tangent and interview every person and look through every archive. And it's exhausting and it's, you know, it takes forever. You have to love it. And I have found something that I am leaning toward doing it. I think when I find out more, I'll know for sure, but I think I probably will do it. It is a very inspiring story, and it's I'm hoping that it will work out for me. It's something that's actually been in my head quite a while. And I won't settle on something that isn't going to do that for me, because it's just too big a project and too much of your life if you're not in love with it. But I think I may have found it.
Well, boy, that gives us something to look forward to. And I guess... I guess I should ask you in closing, with regard to this specific film, Unbroken Path to Redemption, you've seen it. You said at the end you were in tears. So people who are thinking about going to check it out as it opens September 14th and they have the red carpet premiere in Fresno, California on September 15th, what's the number one reason you think people should go check it out?
I think this movie can breathe life into you. It is immensely inspiring. It's very, very beautiful. Because it shows you all that a human being can be, all that we can overcome. The horizon of our potential is limitless. And that was the truth that Louis lived. And so I highly recommend people see it. I think it's absolutely beautiful and so well directed, so well acted, so well written. It just I don't have criticisms of it. I think it's absolutely lovely.
Wonderful, wonderful. Laura, thank you so much for your time and for your contributions to the world with these outstanding writings, and we will look forward to that next inspiring story you've got your fingers on.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be on with you.
That's Laura Hillenbrand, author of Unbroken and one of many who's been truly inspired by Louis Zamperini's story of perseverance and hope. Unbroken, Path to Redemption opens Friday, September 14th at theaters all over the country. And if you can make it to the middle of California on September 15th, I have the information online for you about that red carpet event with Louis' son Luke, as well as actors and the producers from the film. You can find all of that at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Louis Zamperini competed for our country in the Olympics. He fought for our country in World War II. And his victory in his personal fight against PTSD and those invisible scars of war is one that will continue to inspire for decades to come. We're out of time for today, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.